You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Peter Ernest, the executive director of the museum. I served for some 36 years in the Central Intelligence Agency, largely as what is called an operations officer or a case officer. Every month, we'll be bringing you interesting talks with visitors, with authors, with others who have something to do with the world of intelligence and espionage. Today is the 1st of December, 2006, and we are going to take you back to one of the high periods of the Cold War and to one of the extraordinary events that happened during that period, and that will be what came to be known as the defection of Stalin's daughter. And my guest today is Bob Rail, who was a career CIA officer and was the individual who actually escorted her out of New Delhi. An event that captured headlines around the world and put him and the whole event on the front page of Time magazine and newspapers all around the world. Now, by pure happenstance, a member of our board, General Oleg Kalugin, whom you have heard previously, happened to stop by this morning. And he, at that time, which was 1967, was the deputy chief of station, or the deputy resident, as they're called, here in Washington, D.C. So he had personal awareness of that whole situation and has some interesting comments. Now, before we get to that, we thought it might be interesting today to discuss the case of Alexander Litvinenko. As you know, he is the former KGB officer who recently died in London of very mysterious circumstances, assumed by many to be an assassination. That is not totally clear at this point. But since all three of us are here and we all have views, we thought that would be of interest to you. Let me start with General Kalugin, Oleg. Again, a member of our board, former chief of counterintelligence for the Soviet intelligence service, the KGB, and now living in America and an American citizen. Oleg, you knew, I know a number of people who both were in the KGB when Litvinenko was and who are still in the KGB. Let me just ask you your unadulterated view of the situation.
I have no doubts that Colonel Litvinenko was assassinated by the Russian security services. This guy, once he emigrated to England, was targeted by the services. And all of these guys who defected to the West in one way or another, particularly in the Soviet days, were targeted for assassination. Litvinenko's case was special. He revealed the ugly picture of the KGB involvement in the bombing of Russian apartment houses in 1999, which provided or actually propelled the guy, totally unknown at the time, Vladimir Putin, to the Russian presidency, because he was the one who said as a chief of the Russian FSB at the time that Russia will take care of the terrorists. And many Russians felt that this guy will really lead the country out of the crisis. Well, Litvinenko wrote a book which was very convincing in facts he presented about the KGB involvement in that deliberate bombing of the Russian apartment houses. But he did more than that. When he settled in London, he started to contribute on a regular basis to the Chechen press website. The Chechen's website belongs to the Chechen, terrorists or freedom fighters. That depends how you view them. They do use terrorist methods. That's correct. And yet they represent the voice of the free Chechnya. Hopefully one day it will be just as independent as Ukraine, Central Asia, Baltic states, and some of the republics of the Caucasus. Well, anyway, Litvinenko contributed weekly. And in his attacks on the current Russian policies, he particularly emphasized the ugly role of the president of Russia. And in fact, some of his attacks on the president, personal attacks, were so vicious that I myself, when I read these pieces, I thought, well, this will end badly for Mr. Litvinenko. He would not discuss simply the politics of the Russian president, but he would discuss the personal traits, some of the flaws of character, some insulting, humiliating for any person, true or not. And I thought, well, Litvinenko will end badly. And that's precisely what happened. I do not rule out that it was Putin, as president of Russia, said, well, this guy, and we know Putin, I mean, the Russians know, as a vengeful guy who never forgets things which he believes are insulting and humiliating. He ordered the assassination, and the FSB carried it out in London.
Well, let me ask you, Oleg. I think one of the things that turns up in conversations I have is people are struck by the fact of his death, and if it was a poison like this polonium 210 that's being alleged, it seems awfully sloppy, awfully something that couldn't be controlled, that now they're finding in hotel rooms and the restaurant and now on jetliners. And whereas when one thinks of assassination, one thinks of something done with precision, whether it's a rifle shot or a bullet to the head, or you know, those assassinations in history, even with Trotsky, of course, it was an ice pick to the head, but it was a very pointed, precise act. This seems to be sort of all over the place. I mean, and so it leads people to question the plausibility of its being an assassination.
Well, in this case, unlike assassination by shooting or using the axe or whatever, or automobile accident, there are lots of theories deliberately spread by the Russian security services. There are at least 12 theories today as to what happened to the guy, from his suicide and the fact that he simply was poisoned by fish at the restaurant, and the CIA stood behind another version. The matter is that in the case of a simple assassination, as it used before, it's much easier to find the culprit. In this case, it's not easy. People are confused. The British police has not yet stated it was a murder. They are still investigating. I have no doubts, but they have the evidence. And when they say so publicly, then we will certainly know it came from Russia. And I'm very pleased to find out in the latest news that the British police found traces of radioactive material on the British Airways in the Moscow-London connection that shows the direction where the stuff came from, and that's very significant because, well, things could be said anything. Well, Russian theories, that was Berezovsky, one of the friends of Litvinenko. By the way, Litvinenko was a courageous and honest officer, and he was the one who saved Berezovsky from assassination. So Berezovsky owes him his life. But yet the Russians say, oh, this bad guy, and he's an evil of, you know, embodiment of evil. He just tried to get rid of one of the witnesses of his crimes. So the Litvinenko was killed by the FSB. I have no doubts. I trust the British police will come to the same conclusion. The evidence provided so far is very convincing. Well, let's wait for a few days.
Let me just turn for a moment to Bob Rail, who was, as I said, a career CIA officer, and who actually early in his career actually did serve in Moscow and learned Russian in the course of his career. Bob, I know you're no longer active, as they say, but like Oleg and myself, you're certainly following the events. And I just turn to you for your opinion. How does it look to you?
I agree with Oleg. I think it's got all the earmarks of an assassination. It's like you said, it's a little bit out of the norm of previous assassinations in that this was not a precisely targetable weapon that was used. But I think that Litvinenko definitely had made himself a target, and it's not surprising that someone made him suffer for it.
I notice in the course of all this, of course, the Putin has said the whole idea is silly and ridiculous, and that that his government would cooperate in the investigation. Now, of course, anyone can say that, and you know, you have to take it with a grain of salt. The proof will be in the pudding, but. Is there anything either one of you would like to add, Bob, on the case, or General Kalugin?
The Russian Prosecutor General's office said they will help in the investigation. What else could they say? Could they decline an offer? This is a very understandable position of the Russian officials. It does not reveal anything. They will probably try to mislead the British investigators. Well, that will be their role. But for the public consumption, it's a good gesture of goodwill on the part of the Russians. In fact, President Putin himself said it's a tragedy of anyone killed, and we will participate in the investigation with the British authorities. So that's duplicity. That's what a brand of current Russian regime. That's a brand name, duplicity.
Okay. Well, thank you both for your comments. I would ask you if you could, Oleg, to stay just for our discussion on Bob's role in the Svetlana case and the case of Stalin's daughter, since you were an active KGB officer at the time, then serving in Washington, and had a perspective on the case. Let's go back to you, Bob. I know you've told your story for CIA trainees and others, but could you take us back in a sense to 1967, which was certainly a heyday period for the Cold War? My recollection is that in India, where you were serving in New Delhi, they were, of course, being wooed by the United States and by the Soviet Union. And I think Indira Gandhi was the prime minister at the time, and was, I think, favorably inclined towards the Soviet Union at that time. So that was the political context of the time. If you could take us back to that period as a young officer serving in that country, and how this case arose, how it came to your attention. In other words, you woke up one morning and what?
Well, let me just back up a little bit, Peter, and say that defectors were considered, and probably still are, a major source of intelligence for the United States. And therefore, every United States embassy around the world has prepared itself to receive a defector, or walk-in, as we sometimes call them, properly and securely, and to help them if they're asking for help. If I could just join,
thank you for reminding me of that, that defectors, that is people who deliberately chose to go to the other side, often were an enormous source of information and insight during that period into the Soviet Union or other countries in East Europe where we had very limited access. But there were also, or I should say, and also, there were also defectors who were so high profile, who were such major figures in Soviet society or wherever, that the very fact of their defecting had a significance beyond whatever information they might have. And I think that certainly applies in this case. But go ahead.
Yes, that certainly applied to Svetlana's case because she had very little useful intelligence, some very interesting historical information about her father's death, for example, but her value was in the impact on the world scene of a figure who had been some kind of royalty in the Soviet Union and the daughter of Joseph Stalin himself chose to leave that philosophy and that regime behind and defect to the West.
I know when you and I were talking earlier, you described her as both Stalin and his wife as parents. He was, I think, in her early years, a very loving father, but both he and his wife were real activists in the party. They were often away, and she was raised in that atmosphere.
Yeah, that's correct. But she was 6 years old when her mother died. She still had fond memories of her father. She was not aware of all of the depredations that he committed. She must have known something about them, but still, to her, he was a loving father. She didn't see a lot of him, but their relationship was very loving and friendly, as indicated by those pictures that appeared years earlier in, Life magazine. Yeah, she had chosen to stay out of the limelight. She was not by any means a public figure in the Soviet Union. She was known mainly. She worked as a translator, I believe, probably for one of the literary agencies in the Soviet Union. She had deliberately kept herself away from politics. She didn't want to be involved in any aspect of the life of the Communist Party, or she was of course a member of the party, but she was not active and she was not terribly political. She wanted to be a writer. She was a writer, and did not want to be perceived as trying to build a political career on the basis of her relationship with her father.
Well, as you and I both know, and Oleg is certainly well aware. The decision to defect is often a complex one, sometimes even beyond the knowledge of the person who is defecting. If you could give us sort of a picture of what led to her decision, given that she was a translator, she was equivalent to royalty in the Soviet Union. We can get Oleg's comments on that and the significance of her defection. What then led a woman who was in a very good and affluent position, if you like, to defect?
Well, I'll try to summarize this. First, for years, she had felt that her life was being controlled and directed by the Soviet government. She wasn't, even though she was a princess, you might say, she didn't really have the freedom to do what she wanted. This came to a head maybe 6 months or a year before she defected, when she had made the acquaintance of an Indian communist who was living and working in Moscow and fell in love with him and he with her, and they wanted to get married. The Soviet government, Mr. Kosygin at the time, refused to give her permission to marry. This rankled her and made her furious, really. Then her would-be husband fell ill and died. She suspected some somewhat, I don't think she's really convinced of this, but she suspected that he had medical treatment had been withheld from him, and that had led to his death. So that strengthened her anger. Then she had written a book, and she had completed the book. She was afraid it would never be published in the Soviet Union because it was basically about her father and her life with father. So that was another reason. She was given the opportunity to defect because after her fiancé died, she brought his ashes back to New Delhi. Before he died, he had made her promise that she would personally bring his ashes back to India where he could have a proper Hindu burial. He was a Maharaja, by the way. Even though he was a communist, he was a very prominent person.
Maharaja being the equivalent of sort of a prince in society.
Yes, okay. Right. And in fact, he was the uncle of Brijesh Singh, who was the reputed he was a minister of without portfolio in Indira Gandhi's government, and was reputed to be her lover. So he was very well connected with the Indian government. So the government of India actually put pressure on the Soviet government to allow Svetlana to come to India with Brijesh's ashes. Which they had initially refused to do. It took her 6 months of networking to get this permission to come. So this provided the opportunity, with all that background about her unhappiness over the way she was being manipulated and treated, she actually then got the opportunity to come to the West. It's probably interesting that she fell in love with India as soon as she got there. As I said, her fiancé had been a Maharaja, and so when she went to visit his family with his ashes, she went, even though it was out in a kind of remote part of India, she went to a palace, not to a mud hut, and she was very warmly received by his family. And just absolutely became entranced with the place and wanted to spend the rest of her life there. Her first choice was not to come to the United States, but to stay in India. She tried to get approval working through Brijesh's nephew, Dinesh Singh, ask Indira Gandhi if she could stay, and Indira Gandhi refused to give her permission. She did not want to offend the Soviet government. So that was the situation. She had been given approval by the Soviet government to stay in India only 2 weeks. But to her surprise, when the Indian embassy put the visa in her passport to let her come to India, they gave her a 3-month visa. So she said, ho, 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 I don't have to go back in 2 weeks. And so she stayed in Kalakankar, the Indian village where her fiancé had lived, for the full 3 months. And this caused a good bit of consternation at the Soviet embassy in New Delhi because Moscow was leaning on them saying, why don't you send her back? Why isn't she back here? Get her back here. And she was quietly sitting out there in this palace and refusing to even communicate with the embassy.
Let me just ask, because I want to, at some point in the story, as it becomes more and more public, get a reaction from Oleg. At this point, when she was just living in the village, was there any great amount of publicity, or was this sort of quietly taking place at a low level?
Everything was very quiet. We did not, we meaning the, let's say, not just CIA, but the whole embassy in New Delhi, had no idea that she was there. In fact, we didn't even know that she existed.
everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixth Sense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. Visit sixthsense.com to learn why enterprises choose them.
Okay, now just to keep our story moving along, my recollection is literally one morning you came to work and there was someone there waiting to see an American official.
Well, it was actually in the evening. I was had been out, got home, had a telephone call from the Marine Guard. That was usually some kind of bad news. The Marine Guard would call to tell you that you had left your safe open, and that, of course, would not be good. In this case, he gave me the code phrase that we had worked out in our defective procedures that indicated there was a walk-in at the embassy. I was on the committee that was responsible for handling walk-ins, and I was actually the first person supposed to be called.
Okay, and just very quickly, a walk-in, you and I understand by that, literally someone who has walked into the embassy, perhaps phoned first, but they walk in, and I'm sure the Soviet embassy where you were serving at the time had the same experience. Somebody would walk in. They might ask to see the chief of intelligence. They might ask to see an American official because they had information, but it would trigger a reaction by the Marine Guard, as you said, mm-hmm. And by American officials to try and deal with that efficiently and effectively. So if it was someone of genuine worth, they might or might not agree to go back and provide information, or in this case, that was not the case. Why don't you take it from there?
I arrived at the embassy about 7 o'clock in the evening, and as I recall, it was the 7th of March in 1967, and the Marine Guard on duty just pointed to a little anteroom where she was waiting, and actually she was talking with our consul, a gentleman named George Huey, who was actually the first American official to talk to her, and I was the second one. He just marked time waiting for me to get there. About the first thing she said to me was, "Well, you may not believe this, but I'm Stalin's daughter." Well, she was right. It was pretty hard to believe, bearing in mind that we had no idea that Stalin had a daughter at that time. We had no idea that if he had a daughter, that she was in India, or any of this. Now, the Indian government knew all about this, and they had kept that very carefully a secret from us. I did a double take. She had handed me her passport at this point, and I quickly looked at her passport and to read her name again, and the name, of course, was Svetlana E. Alleluyeva. Well, the E stood for Iosifovna, daughter of Joseph, so I said, okay, that's possible. And then the next way to confirm her identity was she said, well, I asked her immediately how much time she had, And she said, well, she couldn't go back, really. She but before they discovered that she was gone, that she might have the rest of the night, but she was expected for dinner at the home of the former Indian ambassador in Moscow, T.N. Kohl. And she said, I've really got to call him or his daughter and let them know that I'm not coming. So I said, okay, let me dial the number for you. So I quickly looked up Kohl's number, dialed it, and handed her the phone, and then listened as she explained that she had a headache or something like that, was not going to make it for dinner. T.N. Kohl's daughter, by the way, who had been a friend of Svetlana's in Moscow, is the one who brought her the manuscript of her first book, 20 Letters to a Friend, out. And she had passed it back to Svetlana after they got to New Delhi. So that was the situation at that time. She passed those two little simple tests. And so my next act was to call my boss and let him know that this was going on.
Now, as I recall, because you were recounting this to me earlier, there was a certain amount of back and forth cable traffic between your folks and Washington. I would just ask you, maybe we can compress that a bit, but give us a sense of the atmospherics and at what point the case became public.
Okay. The first act that any of us would take upon receiving a walk-in is to get basic biographic data, name and a little bit about the person, and send it by cable to headquarters asking for traces, that is, whatever the files indicate about the person. In her case, there was just no answer. It turned out, I found out later, that we had no information at all about her in CIA files or in the government files, in the FBI files. No, there was just no official record that she existed. But this kind of threw headquarters into a little bit of a paralysis because they didn't know quite what to do, and their answer was not to answer. They didn't send any response at all. The next thing, maybe 2 hours later, I sent a more detailed report, and my boss, a gentleman named David Blee, was a very decisive and a very knowledgeable person about what was possible and what wasn't possible in India. He immediately reasoned that, one, we were not going to be able to determine her bona fides, the expressions we use. That is, we weren't going to be able to determine definitively who she was there in New Delhi. And he said she's got to leave New Delhi. And the only way to get her out would be to leave immediately before she was missed. And he asked me if I would be willing to accompany her, and I said yes. And so we began to devise a plan to get her out of New Delhi and to some other country where we would not be under pressure. He felt that the Soviet Union had so much leverage on the government of India that if we announced that she had defected and was in our embassy, that the embassy would immediately have been surrounded by Indian forces and that we would not have been able to get her out. So we wanted to avoid a major confrontation with the government of India. And she walked in at 7 o'clock in the evening. At about 10 or 10:30, she and I were at the airport getting ready to leave.
Let me just ask you at this point. So far, it hasn't broken in the press. Was there concern on your part, that is you and Blee and your colleagues, that as word or if word of her defection were to leak out, that not only the Indians might react, but the Soviets might react, that is the Soviet presence in Delhi at the time, and that that could take the form of possibly trying to snatch her back, to kidnap her, even possibly you couldn't rule out an assassination or something of that nature. Was that of concern to you at the time?
Yeah, that was definitely a concern because we felt that the Soviets would definitely try to get her back by force if necessary, and probably by putting pressure on the government of India not to let her leave and to get her and return her. So that was a major concern. I think we all realized that her defection, if she indeed turned out to be who she was claiming to be, would be a major psychological blow against the prestige of the Soviet government. So we were sure that they'd make every effort to get her back.
So you were at the airport at 10 o'clock, and you boarded a flight. Now, was that flight bound for the United States, or was it bound for another city?
No, the flight we actually got on was bound for Rome, which is where we eventually went. As I recall, it was a Qantas flight.
Mm-hmm. So, in fact, you boarded. Now, at that point, when you boarded the aircraft, there was no attendant publicity. In other words, nothing had broken.
No, nothing at all. In fact, she had managed to evade the security at the embassy, and they were not aware that she had gone. She had left her room in the guest quarters at the embassy, arranged in such a way that it looked like she was packing. She had left a lot of clothing and things lying around the room and an open suitcase, and she just brought a small handbag with her.
So as the daughter of Stalin, she almost had a sense of what we call tradecraft. That is, she was being somewhat devious even in her flight.
Yes,
to the west.
She did. Now, the American embassy was only about 200 yards away from the Soviet embassy, so she took a very short taxi ride to our embassy. And no one, there was a big party going on at the Soviet embassy, and nobody missed her. She walked out, and nobody saw her get in a taxi. So she showed up and was not missed, as it turned out, until the next morning. She was scheduled to return to Moscow on an Aeroflot flight the next morning at about 11 o'clock, I believe it was, or noon. And this was a weekly flight, and one of the problems we were confronting was that the flight arrived at about 5 o'clock in the morning from Moscow. And when this flight would arrive, a whole delegation from the Soviet embassy would go out to meet the flight because there'd be diplomatic couriers on board and people coming in and people getting ready to leave. And so we wanted to make sure that we got a flight out of New Delhi before this huge contingent of Soviets arrived at the airport and would see us. And actually, that was quite a tense time, because when our plane arrived...
You mean in Rome?
No, in New Delhi, when the plane came in.
Okay.
Because it flew in from Qantas.
Mm-hmm.
They developed a mechanical problem. They had to change the compressor. So we sat in the departure hall at the airport for about 4 hours, waiting while the mechanics changed a compressor. And towards the end of that period, I went out and looked around the main part of the airport, and the Aeroflot people had arrived and were opening up their booth and getting ready for the arrival of the Aeroflot flight. Well, finally, just shortly before they were scheduled to arrive, we finally got airborne.
Now, as I recall, the flight itself was fairly uneventful. But once you arrived in Rome...
Well, once we arrived in Rome, let me just back up and say that I was convinced that we would just touch down in Rome and then immediately proceed to the United States. When we got off the airplane in Rome, I was met by a friend of mine, a colleague of ours, who was deputy chief of our office in Rome. And also... there was some concern also about security. There was some feeling that the Soviets might try, if they had found out that she had defected and that was where we were, there might be an effort to snatch her back in Rome. So we had enlisted the assistance of the Italian intelligence service, and they must have canvassed the whole Capitol for the biggest, toughest, meanest-looking officers they could find. So when we got off the airplane, I thought I was surrounded by the defensive line of the Washington Redskins. These were huge guys. And they took us to a safe apartment where we would spend, as it turned out, the next few days. But the words that greeted me by my colleague was that the State Department refused to allow her to continue to the United States. So I was stunned by that. I couldn't believe it. There was one particular official in the State Department who felt that that relations with the Soviet Union were thawing, were warming up, that we were having a chance of really an opening in the Cold War, an opening to put things on a more peaceful basis with the Soviets. And he was afraid that this would disrupt those efforts. So he flatly said his initial response when he learned that she had defected was kick her out of the embassy. Don't have anything to do with her. But by that time, by the time he sent that message out, we were already at the airport, and the people at our embassy said, well, you're too late. They've gone, and they're on the way to Rome.
Now, once you reached Rome now, because I remember from that period, I remember photographs in the press and so forth of the plane, and I think of you getting off. At that point, the story had broken.
Not yet.
Okay.
It broke in a couple of days later. But we stayed in a safe house in Rome for the rest of that week, really. And what our task was then to find out where she could go. If the United States was not going to accept her, then we had to find her a safe haven somewhere. And we tried all sorts of ideas as to where she could go. Australia, well, she wanted an English-speaking country. She agreed that she could go to Australia or New Zealand, or she turned down South Africa. South Africa, I think, agreed to accept her, but she refused to go to South Africa. But this was all going on for the next couple of days. The State Department and the agency were trying to find a place that would take her. We agreed that Switzerland would be an ideal choice. This was a decision. We approached Switzerland, and this was a decision that had to be made by the Swiss Council, in effect the cabinet of the Swiss government. And they didn't meet until Friday, so we had to wait until Friday to find out.
Let me just ask you, Bob. Here you are. The story has not broken, and there is this tension going on. No idea where she's going to resettle. Just in a word or so, how did she handle herself? What was her state of sort of emotions and mind during that period? What an incredibly tense period that was for her personally.
Yeah, she was the calmest person in the room. Or on the plane, or anywhere. She was totally relaxed. In fact, I guess she showed some tension in the embassy before we left. And while we were at the airport, she was concerned that we were so delayed getting out of New Delhi. Once we got on the plane and we were airborne, I had imagined, okay, I'm going to interrogate this lady all the way to Rome. And I was prepared to do that. And she just turned to me and said, well, I think I'll have a nap. So she went to sleep. So she slept all the way to Rome.
Yeah. So after after those 2 days in Rome, did you get then the go-ahead to go to the States?
We had, I believe it was Wednesday of that week, we got a decision was made that we would, if we had not heard from the Swiss government, that we would catch a flight to the U.S., and so we actually, on Thursday, I believe it was, we actually went to the airport to catch a flight to the U.S. in the afternoon. Now, I should say that the Italians were very eager to get rid of us. They were very embarrassed. If you probably remember that there was a very active Communist Party, a legal Communist Party in Italy that was had a strong delegation in the parliament of Italy, and there was just a lot of concern on the Italian government. Well, how did we get into Italy in the first place? The chief of our office in Rome that first night while we were airborne on the way had called the head of the Italian intelligence service, Admiral Henke, and said, woke him up in the middle of the night and said, we need your help. We have a defector coming in. He said, you wake me up in the middle of the night for a defector? And our man said, well, yeah, but let me tell you who she is. And so he was very concerned, and he knew that his government would not like the idea of her being there. So he said, okay, she can come in, but you got to leave tomorrow. I'll wait until tomorrow to inform the foreign minister, who was then a man named Fanfani. He said, but I'll have to inform him first thing in the morning. Well, we arrived in the wee hours of the morning and were taken to this safe house. Then the next morning, the admiral went to Fanfani and explained what had happened. And Fanfani absolutely exploded. He said, get those people out of this country immediately. And I don't want there to be any evidence that they were actually in the country. Well, they said, okay, technically, we'll say that the International Transit Hall of the airport in Rome is expanded to include that little apartment where they are temporarily housed. So we were never legally in Italy.
Okay, so you when you left, which was on Friday, I gather, or what day did you leave?
We left on Friday, actually, but we had actually gone to the airport on Wednesday to catch a flight to the States. We got there, and were told, no, you can't go. So we had to go back to the apartment again.
Then the story broken by Friday?
Yes, it broke on Wednesday, actually, when the New York Times reporter initially reported that Svetlana had defected in New Delhi, and that accompanied by a State Department officer named Robert Rail, she had flown westward and was presumably somewhere in Europe. By checking, the press can really be effective as investigators when they sense a story. So they had gotten the passenger list of all the flights leaving New Delhi during that night when she defected, and saw her name and my name right there on the passenger list. So we were identified as being on the flight to Rome. I was just identified as a State Department officer at that point. But the next day, New York Times representative in New Delhi, a gentleman named Tony Lucas, discovered through his sources that I was actually a CIA officer. And so he published the story that I was a CIA officer, and that was the end of my cover.
So you were at that point, you were headline news. I remember the cover of Time and other people carrying it. I think you were headline news around the world. When that story broke, Oleg, you were serving as the deputy chief of what we would call a station here at the Soviet embassy. Therefore, you were both responsible for, collecting intelligence, which you did very ably. But also anything that would arise that might be an embarrassment to the Soviet government or anything impinging on the image of the Soviet Union or the embassy would be something you would have, because you were a senior officer, shared the responsibility. What was the effect of this story on you in Washington at that time?
My first reaction was that of disbelief. I could not believe it was true. Then, as I listened to the radio, I understood it was all correct. It was Stalin's daughter. And that carried a symbolic message. Not because she knew much in terms of intelligence, but she would provide a lot of stuff about the life of the Soviet Union under Stalin. But what's more, it struck me as a symbol of the continuous decay in the USSR when people, even a person like Stalin's daughter, could not accommodate to the current regime. And the third thought which occurred to me, that was the most serious error on the part of those who handled her case or her personal affairs in India. The Soviet diplomats, the Soviet KGB, they simply bungled the whole thing. They humiliated her. And that was part of my thoughts at the time. We cannot handle human lives the way we should, because after all, humiliation and distrust, these qualities of the officials and bureaucrats, they push many people to defect, to change their views, to change their attitudes. And Svetlana's case was very special because she represented symbolically the former Stalinist empire, the one which crumbled after Khrushchev's denunciation of Stalin. And in a sense, this was the end of the story. Stalin's daughter, what a paradox, now in the West. Had Stalin known, had he been alive, oh, what a disgrace, what a shocking event for all of us. And that was a shocking event for me, too.
Yeah, I think that in a way what you're saying is that my comments earlier that people like Svetlana, although she didn't, as you say, have intelligence as such, she was symbolic of the disaffection of many other people and had effect probably beyond her own knowledge. I'm sorry, we're going to have to go, but I wanted to come back to you, Bob, just to, I know you, that she did come to this country. She resettled, eventually became an American citizen, was my recollection. But just as we turn from the story, do you have any final comments about Svetlana's flight to the West and your role and how that ended?
Yeah, I would just like to say that, of course, everybody knows that she eventually did come to the U.S. The Swiss were very helpful in giving her a safe haven for 6 weeks while everything cooled down. And eventually the U.S. State Department was persuaded to allow her to enter the U.S. And 6 weeks later, she did and was met by a tumultuous reception when she landed at one of the New York airports. And life has been up and down for her since then, but that's another story.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to have to go now, but I really want to thank both of you, Bob, for coming in. It's sort of one of those highlight moments during the Cold War. I think at some future date, what I'd like to do is pick up where Svetlana has actually made her way west and see how she did in this country in her resettlement and a whole new life. And Oleg, I really want to thank you for, I know you were stopping by for a very brief moment, and thank you very much for staying and being with us through Svetlana's story, which obviously had an effect on all of us. Thank you both, and I look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you, Peter. It was a pleasure to be here, and I'll be happy to come back and finish the story.
Well, thanks, Peter. Thanks again.
Well, we look forward to continuing this dialogue with you. And we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum, that's one word, .org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you.